Okay, swimming. Marathon swimming, it's a sport of swimming a long way, slowly, according to traditionally oriented rules, a very specific set of rules. And the rules are a nostalgic nod to the first English Channel swimmers, Matthew Webb and Gertrude Ederle, in the late 19th and early 20th century. And the rules limit swimmers to a regular textile costume, cap, and goggles, and this becomes important later on, that's what I'm telling you. And the rules disallow any kind of contact with a boat or crew that might support you or give you propulsion. So we're talking about the scale of swimming where the swimming is really all you do that day. And so the iconic marathon swim is the English Channel. This is 21 miles across. It's about 13 and a half hours is the average crossing time. So that scale of swimming, but it's part of a kind of global roster of similar swims that people have on their swim CVs and that they have on sort of bucket lists of to-dos. And so using autoethnographic and ethnographic methods, I've been researching marathon swimming for about 5 years as a swimmer and as a sociologist, including a 2.5-year ESRC-funded project called Becoming a Channel Swimmer, during which I documented my own experiences of training for an English Channel Swimmer in 2010. And I also did, what Kant would call observant participation in a range of training sites and swimming locations and communities in the UK. That's Dover, Malta, Ireland, and Southern California, that's San Francisco. I spent some time in San Diego as well. I also looked at online forums, blogs, sort of media reports, autobiographies, and so on. The research started with a very specific focus on the English Channel and the swimming community around that, but has evolved into a much broader study of marathon swimming as a transnational embodied social practice, and I'm currently writing a book on this called Immersion. If you're interested, there's a blog where I talk about my own swimming very more, and this is the project website where a lot of the papers and stuff are stored. So the material on quantification that I want to talk about is part of a chapter in the book on swimming and consumption. And this is really a new part of the book, so this is its first sort of beginnings of the work in progress. Marathon swimmers love to count. And this is my little collection of toys. Laps, strokes, hours and minutes, meters and miles, degrees of temperature, wind speeds, milliliters of energy drink consumed. The details are documented in diaries, public blogs, discussion forums, social media, and in official swim observer reports, which I'm going to talk about later, and draw on a kind of combination of quantification and tracking technologies, including accelerometer-based watches, which count pool laps for you, GPS tracking and navigational systems of the kind that we see in triathlon and running as well, digital thermometers for water temperature, metronomes for stroke pacing, meteorological devices and websites, as well as real-time pen and paper documentation of swims by observers, and also the use of these more panoptic video technologies specifically for stroke correction. I'll just show you this one. That's me on the left, and this is open water legend Shelley Taylor-Smith on the right. And you can see my kind of wayward 170-degree arm is found wanting against the ideal 113 degrees of Shelley Taylor-Smith, and this is my goal for improvement. So, and that's the goal that we think of, the sort of self-evident goal of these technologies is the drive to be better, to be faster or more efficient or swim further. And it's there as a sort of incentive. And so swim coach and founder of the coaching company SwimSmooth tweeted recently, "What gets measured gets improved." And I think, for swimming, there's a lot that I could say about this, not least as a means of kind of thinking reflexively about my own sort of compulsions towards these small electronic devices and their data as I kind of move through aquatic spaces in various ways. But what I want to talk about today is not to think so much about the performance orientation, but to use marathon swimming as a lens for thinking about, firstly, the ways in which the body confounds quantification, and second, particularly the swimming body, and secondly, the social role of quantification within the community and its in relation to its technologies in producing in-group belonging and also in making the swims real, and I use the term advisedly. So one of the key goals of biosensors and technologies of quantification is to make visible what's invisible. They make, or at least seem to make, the body knowable by extending the optic scope via the rendering of bodily function and movement into a technologically mediated readable form. And the example that I want to use first is this. This is a new technology that's just been being introduced into marathon swimming now from other sporting domains such as American football, as in the tap of the flowing stomach, as well as the space program, which is where it comes from, where it originates, the military and firefighting as well, and it's an ingestible thermometer pill. The CoreTemp core body monitoring system, which is this, made by HQ Inc., is an ingestible pill or capsule, incorporates a crystal sensor that vibrates at a frequency relative to the body's internal temperature. And then this signal can be detected by a data recorder that's passed close to the body across the lower back as one of the most efficient points. And then the pill just passes through the digestive system over a period of 24 to 36 hours, depending on the person, obviously. And it is seen as being a considerable advance technologically from the earlier methods, which were sort of more recently a rectally inserted capsule. Or in the 1980s, in cold water swimming, there were some experiments using rectal probes that were connected by wires and cables to boats. I mean, it's important to think the pill itself is still invasive. It is not an innocent technology. It's invading the body. We think of pills as being very clean. But anyway, it's a new technology. Now, the primary orientation of the technology is safety. And we could talk about the gendering of this as well, with this young woman and then the sort of manly heroics going on at the bottom. But it's seen as offering a way to make visible what can't otherwise be seen, and particularly in contexts where timely warnings of unsafe core body temperatures can be a matter of life and death. It is when absolute accuracy is critical. This is the need point. Like many biosensors, it's a technology through which individuals solicit quantification of the self in collaboration with expert others. You can't operate it yourself. And it's a developing and migrating technology, and it still has many technical problems attached to it, particularly with real-time transmission and the reading of data in the aquatic environment. And without wishing to be too graphic, it does also run up against kind of bodily unpredictability, that swimming is a sport where vomiting and intestinal distress is a kind of inevitable part, which has kind of obvious consequences for an ingestible device. But these technologies raise very interesting questions about what data means, and I think this relates really closely to what Pozzana was saying. So the swim organisation Solo Swims of Ontario have been using ingestible thermometers for safety reasons in research, and they've begun to generate data from these thermometers by inviting all of the swimmers doing long swims there to use them if they're willing. It's very small numbers, so the research, very small numbers of people do these swims, so it's a very kind of slow project, and they've been generous enough to talk to me. Technical difficulties aside, one of the key findings is just how difficult it is to correlate observable physiological and cognitive states with core temperature readings. Without the technology, swims are usually observed from the boat, and the swim observers use base assessments of the swimmer's well-being on observable states, indicators of demeanour, consistency of stroke rate, body position in water, and cognitive awareness, whether you can answer questions, simple questions. But these signs of cold, of hypothermia, are indistinguishable in many cases from the inevitable and but less precipitously dangerous fatigue that you might have towards the end of a swim. And that could lead to a swim being ended prematurely or, more fatefully, not intervening and something bad happening. The water itself affects the predictability of these observable judgments. So body position in the water, for example, would fall to vertical in a state of depletion in fresh water, but not in salt water. Okay, so it's a very flexible judgment. But even with the pill, the core temperature pill, which in theory might circumvent subjective judgment, the work of identifying reliable indicators is confounded by idiosyncratic embodied responses by swimmers to cold. So the researchers have found that in some cases swimmers report being excessively cold and show signs of hypothermia while still retaining a relatively safe core body temperature of over 35 degrees. 35 is considered to be the threshold. But for others, they prove to be able to continue swimming with a good cognitive performance throughout falling core temperatures until they fell into a state of semi-consciousness. So just as BMI, for example, body mass index, tells us very little about the individual health status, core body temperature does not straightforwardly speak its own truth, but rather becomes one part of a constellation of indicators that's used to determine whether a swim is terminated. And so one Californian swimmer who did a research project where she did a long swim and used a pill, it was the research team had clear instructions to keep the data hidden from the official swim observers, because they were worried that the sort of the scientific privileged status of the numbers might alarm the observers and cause them to pull the swim too quickly, when we don't know yet what those numbers mean. So the team are working really hard to kind of do this experimentation, and it's very valuable safety work for all of us. But my point here is that the scientists themselves are more than aware of that just as observable data indicators are unreliable, the unmediated temperature data is an unreliable truth, if you like. And to be useful, if it's to count, it needs to be carefully contextualized. And Anne-Marie Moll talks about this in relation to blood sugar monitoring, and she says that however much you count, your body can't be counted on. And so I wanted to borrow Howe's term. So if we see bodies and technologies as erratic and in context, so Howe's talking about sensory sociology, talks about emplacement. And I want to suggest really that these individual streams of data only make sense when they are emplaced within the social and cultural and embodied environment within which that quantification is taking place. So not only to see it in context, but of the context itself. So I want to move on to the second theme, which is to look at how this data gets mobilized kind of socially to form belonging. One of the features of marathon swimming is that it takes place out of sight. I can tell you that I have swum the channel, but in itself, the sea bears no mark of me having passed through it, and the swim itself was only witnessed by five people, three of whom were paid by me to be there. So there's a disconnect for many swimmers, including myself, because what's experienced as quite a major life event is completely invisible, or almost completely invisible. And this gets addressed among swimmers primarily by translating swims into testimonial objects. Pebbles gathered from the shore, embroidered clothing, car number plates, jewellery, and perhaps most significantly for today, swim charts. Okay, so this is a satellite track of Lake Windermere, and that's a manually drawn track around the island of Jersey. The charts draw heavily on GPS data, which is the spatial and temporal track of the movement of the swimming body. And these are very treasured objects, shared online, framed and publicly displayed, and even written on the body. This is a two-way English Channel swim from last summer by a swimmer called Wendy Tree. It took nearly 40 hours. It's just mind-boggling. That's the GPS track, and it's a beautiful double helix, and she's had it tattooed onto her foot. But if we're even beyond this kind of production of artifacts, the tracking performs a legitimizing function for the swims themselves, for the marathon swimming world. So convention dictates that swims, like the English Channel, require independent observation. You write a detailed report that would include 30-minute entries every 30 minutes, time, location, weather, water, food, stroke rate, etc. This is an emplaced account that puts individual pieces of data in relation to form a fulsome narrative of a swim. And this becomes one of your treasured testimonial objects in itself to make the swim tangible. But it also becomes the basis for official swim ratification. And it's that that gets your name on the list of successful swims, which in itself is a kind of treasured goal. But the total assemblage is greater than the sum of its parts. And this is important. So individual pieces of data, and especially GPS tracks or coordinates on their own, are perceived as insufficient evidence of an unsuccessful swim within the community. So in December 2012, for example, a UK swimmer claimed to have swum the North Channel, which is from Ireland to Scotland, It's one of the hardest swims on the roster and widely considered to be impossible in winter. The swimmer's Twitter feed offered regular numerical GPS coordinates as well as miles per hour pace data. But the community reacted with suspicion. Firstly, because all of the other contextualising information, including the observer's report, was absent. And secondly, because the content of the Twitter feed itself was out of step with data that's usually shared during a swim. So miles per hour figures, for example, while they might be very useful for a triathlete or a runner, are relatively meaningless in an ocean where you've got tides and currents that change the actual moving pace constantly. Also, the precise numerical GPS coordinates are relatively useless without detailed charts and a certain expertise of plotting. Instead, what people usually do is just take a photograph of the screen in the pilot's navigational screen to show the map and the point on the map and tweet that. Okay, so the image of the image is what gets tweeted on mobile phones. What happens more commonly is that swimmers will tweet the GPS link in advance so people can log onto it and follow it in process, which is effectively what you get when you watch this forming. And so you watch it from home. And then the tweets themselves are much more narrative about the swimmer's condition, about the weather, about how many times the crew's been seasick, how many jelly babies the swimmer's eaten, and so on. So in the case of the North Channel swim that I'm talking about, the absence of contextualising information combined with the wrong type of data, of tracking data, compounded doubts within the community about the authenticity of a swim that was already quite shocking as a claim. And it is not to say that he didn't do the swim, and I think one of the interesting things about this is that this kind of normative data practices about what counts can produce quite troubling exclusions as well as belonging. But my point here is one about the kinds of data that the community treats as legitimate and legitimising. Not just any data will do. Not every form of counting counts. And the unseen activity of swimming can only be made visible through normatively determined and privileged assemblages of data and modes of communication. But this community commitment to tracking of and by the swimmer also comes with a big caveat that I find really interesting. This is not a techno-utopian engagement with the imagined endless possibilities of tracking. Instead, there's a palpable caution within the community about what is seen as the threat posed by biosensor and tracking technologies to the defining ethos of the sport, which is one of an unmediated encounter with the natural aquatic environment free from the softening trappings of modernity. Now, we could talk about that a lot, but that's the ethos, that's the kind of stated ethos of the sport. So for many, then, the sport requires what one discussion forum contributor described as future-proofing. So there was an online debate recently about whether wristwatches should be allowed on English Channel swims and similar swims, whether it counted as assistance or not. And the concern was about the future incorporation of tracking and communication technologies into watch-like devices that might produce a level of assistance that was out of step with this kind of stripped-down spirit of the sport. So this is what one of them said, that with the growth of wearable tech, we'll see goggles with head-up display and earbuds that would allow communication, direct communication with the boat and so on. And this is coming soon. There was this real sense of urgent threat. And this chap declared quite emphatically that such devices would make our training and official swims easier and therefore constituted a firm ground for a preemptive ban on all watches and watch-like devices to protect against that. So in spite of the rather optimistic narratives then that we hear about that we're all going to be using these technologies and that this tracking is going to sort of take over, even among a community that's data hungry, technologically engaged and financially able to buy these devices, there is this ambivalence about the data. So community values and standards of swim authenticity mean that tracking technologies that might be used in training might not be used in an actual marathon swim, or vice versa, or real-time feedback might be saved for kind of post-hoc review and vice versa. Okay, and sometimes you might just want to have a nice swim and not use any of them to take the measuring out of it. So, to briefly conclude, to go back to my toys, using these two examples, I've tried to show the contingency that inevitably accompanies attempts to make counting count within a very specific community. So that's in terms of the body's intractability to control, technical unpredictability, normative in-group values, about what counting counts, and reflexive engagements that render what appears to be socially a seamless drive to quantify actually into episodic and strategic engagements and disengagements. I want to suggest that what sociology perhaps can bring to this field is the capacity and readiness to emplace those technologies, practices, and data in their wider context, not just putting them in context, but making them part of that context. As a swimmer, I maintain my allegiance and, frankly, rather covetous relationship with my handful of gadgets and their outputs. But as a sociologist, I think there is a need and potential for making that an emplaced perspective that can incorporate that wider context and social values that make counting count. And then perhaps to use that, not just in this context, but in the broader health context perhaps, to think about which or whose knowledges are being privileged and resisted, and to what social and embodied effect. Thank you.